Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On this Independence Day, a brash American banker humbles himself before Britain's parliament. Well, sort of. Barclays ex-CEO Bob Dimon gets grilled on the growing rate-fixing scandal. He's blaming it on a few rogue traders. Is it just me, or haven't we heard that line somewhere before? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, July 4th. Happy holiday, everybody. Let's start with the story of an American banker testifying before lawmakers about a financial scandal. Hard-charging, sure of himself, but savvily contrite. And no, we're not talking about J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon last month. This is Bob Dimon, the American executive who recently resigned as CEO of Barclays, the banking powerhouse based in Britain. Dimon testified before a committee of the British Parliament today about charges that Barclays manipulated a key interest rate called the LIBOR. The bank's already been fined over $450 million. And as Marketplace's Stephen Beard tells us, that's just the beginning of the fallout.
Sparks were supposed to fly. Bob Dimon, we were told, is as hard as his mineral namesake, and he was furious, having been turfed out of his job as one of Britain's top bankers. But in today's hearing, he came across as rather meek. He actually apologised for the LIBOR interest rate rigging by what he said was a small number of Barclays staff.
That behaviour was reprehensible. It was wrong. I'm sorry. I'm disappointed. And I'm also angry.
He emerged largely unscathed from the hearing, but his former bank might not be so lucky. Barclays and some of the other 15 banks involved in the LIBOR system now face multi-billion-dollar lawsuits in the United States. Anyone whose loan or investment was pegged to LIBOR could claim they lost out from the bank's dishonesty. Hedge fund manager Manal Mehta.
It is virtually impossible to decipher just the true scale and scope of this liability because the numbers are just so astronomically large.
But William Black, a banking expert from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, believes that some on Wall Street will be crowing over the LIBOR scandal. It's one in the eye for the old rival, London.
LIBOR was the crown jewel of what the Brits had going for them in the City of London. It was their thing, and it was immensely valuable to them, and they've taken that crown jewel and they've completely spoiled it, and they've done so out of pure greed.
The crown jewel has certainly lost a diamond. In spite of his smooth performance, Bob is thought unlikely to land another major banking job, at least on this side of the pond. But he does have a banker-type payoff to console him, which today he declined to forego, a reputed $48 million. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And here in the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration is making news. The FDA has approved the first quick take-home test for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. So soon, consumers are going to be able to go to the drugstore, buy an HIV test kit, and get their results in private, all in less than an hour. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports on the pros and cons of a product that many couldn't have imagined back in the 80s when the AIDS epidemic was at its height.
Here's how the home test will work. You swab your gums, wait 20 to 40 minutes, and just like a home pregnancy test, lines pop up to let you know if you're positive for HIV or not. Michael Weinstein is head of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. He says being able to test in private means more people might get tested.
The value of the test is that there are people who will not go to their doctor and don't want to talk about their sexual practices and are embarrassed or worried about it showing up on their insurance.
But there are some downsides to do-it-yourself HIV testing. Christopher Hurt is a professor at UNC's School of Medicine.
The test is helpful if the result is positive. It tells you something reliable if the test is positive. If the test is negative, it doesn't always mean that you don't have HIV.
The FDA says 1 in 12 HIV-infected individuals could get a false negative result with the test. Plus, there's the issue of cost. OraSure, the company that makes the test, hasn't announced the price, but says it'll be higher than what it charges clinics because of the extra packaging, labeling, and a 24-hour hotline. Some experts estimate the testing kit could be nearly $60.
That's going to be prohibitively expensive to a number of people and to the populations that are going to be most at risk of getting infected.
Mary Jane Rotherham is a professor at UCLA. Still, she thinks the FDA's approval is a big step forward. She says more people knowing their status should mean fewer new cases of HIV. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
U.S. markets got the day off, but that doesn't mean the world stops spinning. Europe, Asia market details when we do the numbers. It hasn't been the most pleasant of holidays for a lot of Americans. Record-breaking heat, wildfires, those power outages in the Midwest and the East. Hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses still don't have electricity. A lot of cities have canceled their traditional fireworks celebrations. The fire threat's just too great in some parts of the country. But in Coral Gables, Florida, the party is on. Cynthia Birdsill is the city's director of economic sustainability. Ms. Birdsill, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Since we've caught you in your office today, I assume that you must be preparing for tonight's big fireworks show.
Yes, we have a lot of logistics. We're expecting 25 to 30,000 people.
Now, I understand Coral Gables hasn't had a fireworks display on the 4th for a long time. When was the last time you had one?
It was in 2006, so it's been 6 years.
What happened?
I think, you know, there were budget constraints, and then, you know, with the economy, we just didn't get back to having it in the budget.
How much does it cost a community like Coral Gables of about, what, 47,000 people to put on one of these big fireworks displays?
This year it's costing about $130,000.
Wow.
That includes the fireworks. We have a band that's going to play, so there's a stage and all that kind of equipment as well.
So I'm assuming that the city's finances didn't magically get healed since 2006. You've had some financial help. Who's paying for this?
This year, our city commission passed a sponsorship ordinance that allows us to work with corporate sponsors on events. So one of our key sponsors is Bacardi USA, and another is Del Monte Fresh Produce. They both have their corporate headquarters in Coral Gables, so they're giving back to the community, and we're also thrilled to be able to help promote them.
Why did this law pass in the first place? Was Coral Gables, like a lot of cities, having trouble funding a lot of services, and you felt you needed to turn to the private sector?
Definitely. You know, we had a lot of cuts in the last couple years. We've been able to retain all of our core services, but you know, the extras, like the fireworks, were the things that we couldn't put back in.
Cynthia, tell me, what does it mean to the city of Coral Gables that they are finally going to have a fireworks show on July 4th for the first time in, what, 6 years?
What's really wonderful is seeing this sense of community. I really love my job working for this city, and in part, it's we have a small town feel, even though we have big infrastructure and big corporations here. So I love the fact that I know people and that everybody's come together to do this.
Cynthia Birdsill is Economic Sustainability Director in Coral Gables, Florida, not far from Miami. Ms. Birdsill, thanks a lot, and happy 4th of July.
You too. Thanks so much.
After tonight's fireworks, it's officially summer, folks. Not the season, you understand, but the feeling. You know, July and August, everything slows down a bit. There are more backyard barbecues and picnics and all that fresh produce to look forward to at the local farmers market. The strawberries at the one near my house yesterday almost inspired me to make strawberry shortcake. Well, almost. Point is, all that farmers market food is grown close to home, which we have been told is the best for our health and for the environment. But commentator Pierre Desrochers says, not really.
If taken seriously, locavorism would not only mean lower standards of living and shorter life expectancies, but also increase environmental damage. Think of it this way. Because nobody would bother transporting foodstuff over long distances if it didn't deliver superior outcomes, locavorism can only result in higher prices and less variety. A less varied diet is inevitably less nutritious. Higher prices also leave less money in local pockets to spend on other things, in the process destroying jobs both at home and abroad. Furthermore, foreign food exporters no longer have the means to purchase other goods produced in the locavore's community. In addition, producing food in the most suitable locations and delivering it over long distances is actually much greener than growing vegetables or manufacturing dairy products locally. The local operations require energy-guzzling heated greenhouses instead of natural heat and massive amounts of irrigation water rather than abundant rainfall. It is better to grow tomatoes in the Florida sun than in a heated greenhouse in upstate New York. The most preposterous claim of locavores is that their prescription increases food security. Yet, no local food system can ever be completely protected from insects, plant and animal diseases, droughts, floods, earthquakes, and other natural catastrophes. Fortunately, trade liberalization ensures that the surplus of regions with good harvests can be channeled to those with below-average ones. In the long run, good and bad harvests cancel each other out. Locavorism, by contrast, puts all of one's agricultural eggs in one regional basket.
Pierre Desrochers is an associate professor of geography at the University of Toronto. His new book is called The Locavore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet. Well, let us know what you think of the virtues or not of locally produced food. Just go to our website and click on the link that says contact. Whatever your feelings about locally produced food, you probably also have an opinion or two about beer. Well, it turns out mainstream beer sales are down, but sales of hard cider are growing nearly 20% a year. Cider, sort of like fruity beer, makes up just a tiny fraction of the alcohol industry in this country. But big beer companies like Anheuser-Busch and Miller Coors have recently jumped into the market. Small craft producers are cropping up all over the country, too. Vermont Public Radio's Nina Keck has the story.
Hard cider isn't new. If John Adams or another founding father got thirsty, it was usually cider they'd order at the local pub. But as German immigrants brought their beer-making skills to America,
in München steht ein Hofbräuhaus,
cider fell out of fashion. Yeah, prohibition didn't help much either. But today, hard cider is making a comeback.
This is where I keep the woodchuck, right here, through here.
Bob Caluti sells beer and wine in Rutland, Vermont. Walking into his store's cooler, he points out several brands of cider.
I usually maintain about 4 to 5 SKUs or different packages of it at every given time.
It's a small niche market, he says, but sales are growing fast among both men and women.
Oh, I definitely think the potential's there. I mean, cider's been around forever. And then if you throw in the whole gluten-free aspect, there's a lot of people that can't have gluten, which is obviously a common factor in beer. So I think cider's here to stay.
The best-selling cider in America, Woodchuck Amber. It's been made in Vermont since 1991. Brett Williams heads the Vermont Hard Cider Company, which makes Woodchuck and handles three other brands of cider.
When I started with the company way back when, all we heard was no. People didn't know what hard cider was. Now I'm worried about whether we can keep up with demand and make enough product.
Woodchuck's popularity helped spur an explosion of small craft cider producers across the country. And even the big boys hope for a piece of the action. Miller Coors recently purchased the Crispin Cider Company of Minnesota, while Anheuser-Busch just launched Michelob Ultra Light Cider. Paul Chibe is vice president of marketing for Anheuser-Busch.
When, you know, the major players, the larger players in market get involved with a category, we're going to bring a lot of interest to the segment.
The U.S. cider market is still tiny, less than 1% of the beer industry. That's nothing compared to Great Britain, where cider makes up over 15% of their beer market. Chibe says it's unlikely the U.S. cider market will ever grow as big as the U.K.'s, but he says there's still tremendous potential.
When you look at the profiles, you think about consumers' interest in variety. You see how big the white wine segment is in the U.S. and its broad appeal. There's no reason why cider can't be significantly larger in our market.
That growth is something the Vermont Hard Cider Company is both counting on and struggling with. At the company's bottling plant in Middlebury, Brett Williams just added a third shift and can still barely keep up with demand.
The product that you see on the conveyor right here is going to go on that pallet. The fork truck's going to pick it up, and it's going to go right on a truck, and it's out the door.
Williams says next summer they expect to be shipping out lots more cider. Construction just started on a new $24 million headquarters that he says will double the company's output. In Middlebury, Vermont, I'm Nina Keck for Marketplace.
Coming up, what makes a song a summer hit?
Something that's danceable in the club. It's anthemic. It has lyrics that people can memorize easily. There's a lot of quotables in the song.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street was off today, but European markets took a break from one of their best three-day runs in months. Germany's DAX index slipped 0.2%, while the British FTSE and French CAC 40 each dropped about 0.1%. Trouble followed Barclays from the halls of Parliament to the London Stock Exchange. Shares fell nearly 0.2%. Asian stocks ended the day on an up note. Japan's Nikkei edged higher 0.4%. And what the heck, let's do Australia. Australia's S&P ASX 200 tacked on more than 1%. You're listening to Marketplace, mate.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. It's back to work for those of you with one day off for the 4th of July holiday. Chain retailers like Kohl's and Macy's release their June sales numbers. And on July 5th, 1937, spiced ham, or Spam, hit grocery store shelves for the first time. That's 75 years of cold or hot, Spam hits the spot. I'm Bridget Bodner.
You're listening to Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. As we celebrate Independence Day here, over in the United Kingdom, scandal is brewing, as we noted earlier, around the big banks, Barclays in particular. So without further ado...
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
And because it is the 4th of July, we bring you What's Up Europe, the expat edition. Jeff Moody just moved to Worcester, England from Waco, Texas, where he's starting up an office for an American company. And Matt Smith has been living in Edinburgh since last year with his Scottish wife. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Sarah, and happy 4th of July.
Yeah, happy 4th.
Happy 4th to you, too. So, Matt, let's start with you. You're in Edinburgh, Scotland. What is the big topic of discussion over there?
Well, we've got a couple of issues here with the banks. The gentleman from down south, head of Barclays Bank, definitely since a little bit of trouble.
Jeff, what about in Worcester? Are people talking about Barclays? What are they saying?
Absolutely. And one of the funny things is I just opened my account at Barclays last week. And so it really resonated. And I shouldn't be telling everybody this, but I do spend some time in the pubs. But it was kind of funny. The other night, a gentleman was coming up and ordering a beer and basically almost trying to scream at the top of his lungs about how Barclays was ripping everybody off. And I said, well, you know, they didn't rip me off because I just opened my account there. And he goes, oh, yeah, they're ripping you off. And he was a very lively spirit and really raising it up in the bar about the Barclays. And then obviously where I'm hanging out, they're talking a lot about football, which I used to call soccer, but Dave Beckham not making the Olympic team has caused a huge stir over here.
Yeah. Now, you are in the West Midlands, Jeff, and I know that you work for a U.S.-based franchising company called Dwyer, and evidently you've hired some people, so the economy must be doing okay.
Well, where I am, the economy is thriving. I mean, there's new construction going on. The shops are very vibrant. The car parks are just full and hard to get into. So The area I'm in seems to be very vibrant.
Matt, what about in Edinburgh? How's the economy doing there? And are people talking about the financial crisis?
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, you've got Edinburgh here, you know, kind of the financial center. So it is very much on the mind of folks. You've got a lot of people, too, that are, they just kind of go on with life. there's still big full-page adverts for tourism and doing holidays and special deals. I mean, yeah, some people aren't buying such extravagant holidays, but they're still going.
Yeah. Jeff, now we mentioned that you are hiring people in Worcester. You're from Waco, Texas. Are you finding any cultural disconnects there? Is it something to adjust to?
Absolutely. I mean, my first experience driving on the other side of the road with a 5-speed was quite an experience. But, culturally, I use the wrong terms a lot of time. Pants over here don't mean the same thing as pants over there.
What do pants mean over there?
They're undergarments. And so they call them trousers. And so I've made a few missteps, but my team is very cordial in the way that they kind of correct me. But yeah, there's a lot of cultural differences, but it's been a great experience so far.
So how are you two going to celebrate the 4th of July today? What are the plans? Matt?
Well, shockingly, I'm actually in a baseball league here in Edinburgh. So I will be playing baseball on British soil at a park here.
Now, how long have you been in Scotland?
I've been here since December.
And I must say, I hear a hint of a Scottish accent there.
Man, you wouldn't be the first one to say that. Everyone thinks I'm Canadian here, and my family at home thinks I'm Scottish.
That's great. Okay, Jeff Moody in Worcester, England, and Matt Smith in Edinburgh, Scotland. Thanks a lot, gentlemen, and happy 4th of July.
Thank you, and happy 4th of July to all my friends in America.
Yeah, happy 4th back home.
If you want to see some skyrockets today, try taking a look at the target return for a lot of pension plans, especially the yields that are promised to public employees. Some of them are guaranteeing returns as high as 8%. Say, what? These days, most investors are lucky to get a small yield. Government bonds have been paying record lows of maybe 2% tops. So what's the magic behind these pension fund returns? In today's installment of Money Matters, our regular series on consumer finance, senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports it could be a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Pension experts are getting anxious about those supposed 8% returns because the only way to generate that kind of growth is pouring cash into increasingly risky investments, including debt that you might know as junk bonds. Economic consultant Anirban Basu has been tracking the pension funding shortfall for Baltimore's Sage Policy Group.
Either you're going to hit 8% by taking on big risks, or you're going to fall short by not taking enough risk. And the worst possibility is that you take big risks and you get a negative 8%.
Translation, pension fund managers are gambling retirement money on an elusive target. Maybe you're thinking this doesn't apply to you because you're calling the shots on your own 401k plan. Those returns can always vary. But consider that public pension plans are increasingly reliant on that magic 8% assumption. Andrew Biggs is a pension analyst at the American Enterprise Institute.
The downside is the benefits are guaranteed. So the taxpayer has to pay the benefits regardless of how the investments turn out. If the investment returns turn south, then the taxpayer is on the hook.
At Towson University, economist Araya Sarani warns when the payments come due, we could all feel the sting. Either that or public workers need to brace for a much smaller retirement nest egg than they've been expecting.
There's some studies out there that show it could be somewhere about $1,300 per taxpayer to pay for all these pensions. I know many states and many localities are going to revise downward their pension obligations.
Those cutbacks would hit future employees. The experts we spoke to warn politicians have kicked this can down the road about as far as they can, hoping to make it someone else's problem. But the bill is now coming due. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Remember this song?
There's a fire starting in my heart.
Isn't that just so July 4th, 2011? As is now typical with Top 40 Radio, you hear Adele's Rolling in the Deep every once in a while, sort of a nostalgic throwback to, well, last summer. So what's rocketing up the charts right now? And what makes a Top 40 hit into a number one summer blockbuster? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman got the beat on that one.
Unless you only listen to the kind of radio we produce here at Marketplace, you've probably heard this song at least once in the last, 59 minutes.
Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy.
Canadian waif pop singer Carly Rae Jepsen soared out of obscurity this spring with her bouncy love song Call Me Maybe.
The forecast is that she may remain on top of that summer list.
That's Silvio Pietrolongo, director of pop charts at Billboard magazine.
There is some competition there, so you know I'm not going to say that the race is over, but she's got a great head start.
And who's nipping at Carly Rae's heels? Pietrolongo puts the odds on Maroon 5 and their hit Payphone. Trying to call home all of the change I spent. Okay, you get the idea. Pietrolongo also likes Where Have You Been by Rihanna and Wide Awake from Katy Perry.
You know, a few years ago it was really hip-hop that was doing well and some R&B songs. So, you know, everything has its cycle, and right now we're at a pure pop cycle.
The cycle itself, that's also a big part of the formula. The same songs every hour in rotation.
All right, 2 o'clock, Brett Andrews Radio Show, checking in with Maroon 5, Wiz Khalifa on the way, Katy Perry, and...
Brett Andrews is program director and afternoon DJ at Z100, a top 40 station in Portland, Oregon.
It is very formulaic. We do have numerical systems in place. The most important thing for us is familiar, familiar, familiar. People like to turn on the radio and hear a song that they can sing along to.
But in the case of Carly Rae Jepsen, Americans had barely heard anything from her. Then she got some big assists. Justin Bieber and Selena Gomez lip-synced a tribute video to her song, and it went viral.
Even former Secretary of State Colin Powell was caught on camera singing that song. It's moved away from just being a fun little pop song to being this viral kind of a cultural identifier for the summer.
And me? I like a song called Drive-By by the post-grunge rock band Train. I like underdogs. Right now, they're holding at number 19 on the pop charts. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, you've heard the phrase the curse of the skyscraper. You know, the idea that when a city builds some spectacularly tall building, it's a harbinger of economic doom. Like the Empire State Building gets completed and bam, the Great Depression hits. Well, tomorrow, the Shard will officially open in London. It's the tallest building in Europe at over 1,000 feet high. With Britain's double-dip recession and now the Barclays scandal, looks like that skyscraper curse is the real thing. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope you couldn't join us tomorrow. This is APM.